This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher have been joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene, politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio, tonight at 7 o'clock, on podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who tells us he's on his way, and me, Samuel Mann. Tonight's guest is Lloyd Spencer-Davis, who is the Stewart Professor of Science Communication at the Centre for Science Communication of Otago University. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So who was Stewart, the Stewart Professor?
I don't know who he was in person, but it's basically a body that used to run the University Halls of Residence, and they essentially established the chair. I've got an endowed chair in science communication, and they made a donation, which was matched by the government, and that basically pays my rent.
And you are in the Centre for Science Communication. We'll come back to that.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
But can you give us a quick intro to what that is?
Science communication is about popularizing science, and the centre essentially tries to train students in the theory and the practice of how to make science interesting for the population at large. So taking a complex subject and not dumbing it down, but making it easily understandable.
And you, before you did that, you were known as the Penguin Guy.
Some people still know me as the Penguin Guy, actually. I'm still referred to as Prof Penguin sometimes. And I still have a hand or flipper in the penguin research.
And going back before that, you were born in, you came from Napier originally?
Yes, I don't like to admit that, but you've done your research. Yeah, that's true.
It's on your website.
Well, it is, yeah. You know, but I didn't write that. But yeah, no, I have to admit I came from Napier, yeah. There were worse places to come from. It could have been Hastings, for example.
And growing up, did you always know you were going to be a scientist?
I think from about six or seven, I knew that I wanted to do something with nature. Not necessarily a scientist. I was probably about 13 when I realized that I wanted to be David Attenborough or Gerald Durrell, and particularly that animal behavior was what attracted me.
In your book, what's it called, Looking for Darwin, you tell the stories of struggling with the religion and science from that early age. Did that carry on through school?
Yes. It's hard to believe when you look at me, but I actually did have a very religious upbringing, and that mainly came from my mother. When I was very young, I used to have to go down to the church four times a week.
So now we're joined by Shane Gallagher. Welcome, Shane.
Hello. Sorry for being late. This is a bit one of those days where everything's kind of going wrong.
So we're talking about growing up in Napier.
Ah.
Yeah, I'm a troubled lad because of it, apparently, but I've survived. When I was very young, I had a very religious upbringing, mainly due to my mother, and I used to have to go down to the church four times a week. And then it was when I was at high school, I was about 13 and going through confirmation classes, and the vicar came in one night completely pissed on wine and fell over the pew, and I think it was at that point a little light bulb went off in my head which said, this just can't be right. And it made me really question, what I thought about God and the state of play, about, who we are and so forth. And I became more and more interested in science and natural selection and things like that. And so While I was at high school, I did a professional stream, I think. So it was languages and geography, but it included a lot of science, and including biology and chemistry and that. So I definitely had a preference for science from an early age.
So you did a science degree?
I did. I went to Victoria University and did my undergraduate degree there in zoology, and took it in a fairly quick fashion because I had desires for travelling overseas in a bus and going all around Europe. But the friend that was going to go with me ended up meeting a young lady, and our plans for travel got sidetracked. But I did complete my degree in 2.5 years, which was quite fast, actually. Yeah, not with very good, well, actually, okay marks, but, you know, it was more about getting it done so I could travel.
And did you travel before you went and did your PhD?
Not really, because my friend wouldn't come with me. I actually went, and it was actually quite a seminal moment. I decided that I really didn't want to go to Europe by myself, and so I went up to Auckland, and that was when I got exposed to the ideas of sociobiology, and this was just happening, and there was a new lecturer who was taking the course, a guy called John Craig, and it really made me realize this is what I want to do, and so I subsequently carried on, did a bit of work in the Antarctic, but I eventually got a scholarship to go to Canada to work on sociobiology, behavioral ecology. And it was at that point, I guess, my travelling really started in earnest. Up to then, I'd only really been to Australia.
So what is behavioral ecology?
It's really the study of the behaviour of animals and their ecology, but from an evolutionary perspective. So it's trying to treat behaviour in the same way that you might treat a red breast on a robin, or you know, the giraffe's neck. You're trying to explain it from the point of view of how did it get there, or what purpose has it got from an evolutionary point of view. You know, what advantage does it give the animal, or whatever. So it was really quite a major shift in our understanding of behavior, because up till then we had the guys like Lorenz and Nico Tinbergen and that, and they were explaining behavior based on what they called fixed action patterns and things like that. So it was very descriptive about what was happening. So you could describe everything that was happening in an animal, but it was only when you started applying the principles of natural selection and, you know, Darwinian sort of understanding of evolution to behavior, you actually realize that there's no reason why an animal's behavior, which we think of as being really labile and, you know, sort of not so fixed, but there's no reason why that's not as controlled by evolution as, say, you know, the length of their leg, or, you know, the color of their eyes, whatever.
And how do you tell, difficult question maybe, behavior that's an evolutionary advantage and behavior that's just an accident? That's just the in-between bits of...
That is a very perceptive question, because that is really the heart of it. And behavioral ecology and sociobiology took a hell of a lot of stick very early on, because everyone grabbed onto it. They thought, this is fantastic. We'll describe all this behavior in terms of its evolutionary advantage. But it turned out to be BS, a lot of it, because, you know, just like, you know, some aspects of an animal's body may not really influence its survival or reproduction that much, similarly with behavior. And yet people were making up what we call just-so stories. They were seeing that, you know, an animal did a certain thing, and they would say, ah, well, that must be because it gives it some sort of advantage. And really they weren't doing the tests. And the only real way to answer your question is to actually do the tests and make sure that the behavior observing actually influences the animal's reproductive success, and really, if you're doing it properly, it's lifetime reproductive success.
You can't do that with hundreds of penguins.
No, and that's why, another good question, that's why penguins are not really a great animal to study this stuff. Mostly they worked with things that have really short lifespans and were breeding a lot, and you know, you could manipulate and do whatever you like to them without causing ethics committees to go berserk. And so a lot of people worked on things like bees and things like that when they did all this early work. When I came to do my PhD, I worked on ground squirrels, which are small mammal, and they have the advantage in that they reach reproductive maturity very early for a mammal, like 1 year, and they reproduce. And so even in the course of a PhD, you could get 2 or 3 generations, which was an advantage, whereas if I worked on penguins, I'd be about 100 before I finished my PhD.
So one of the things that I've always found fascinating is the idea that individual behavior can be, you know, can influence an individual's reproductive, you know, ability or not. But there's also emergent behavior in a group of individuals, which may or may not be kind of terribly related to their individual properties or behavior patterns. I'm thinking of ant colonies and bee colonies and, you know, those kind of large, you know, and they kind of operate like an organism in and of itself.
Yeah. And again, you guys, these are very sharp questions, because really that sort of behavior, when Darwin came to write on The Origin of Species, he almost didn't do it because of that very problem that if you look at a bee colony, for example, you have worker bees there that don't reproduce, and yet they clearly help the queen, you know, produce themselves and that. And based on his theory, he thought, well, how can you explain this? How can you explain that this concept, it's called altruism, where an animal behaves seemingly for the good of a group or others, but at its own expense? And that doesn't work from an evolutionary point of view, from a natural selection, because animals should behave selfishly, according to Darwin. And the trick was, the answer to understanding it, is that you need to look at the genetics, and where animals are behaving like that, they are invariably very closely related to the animals they're helping. So, actually, invariably is a wrong word, because in some cases, a few instances, they're not, but that's a separate example. But for the majority, the vast majority of instances of so-called altruism, be it worker bees that reproductively sterile, or an animal like a ground squirrel that might give an alarm call to alert other squirrels at its own expense, because when an alarm calls, it exposes itself to the predator. Where they do that, they've got close relatives around. And the theory goes that it doesn't matter about your own body. It doesn't matter about you. It's your genes. And if the animals are closely related to you, they share those genes with you. And therefore, by promoting their reproductive success, in effect, you're promoting your own.
Because one of the things I've always been puzzled about, you know, the idea of the selfish gene, was it seemed to me that it was very influenced by politics. I thought it was the concept of individualism, and whether that comes from politics or philosophy or wherever it comes from, it was something that was in the air at the time, and that it seemed to give an answer. You know, the selfish gene. You know, each individual must strive to maximize their benefit. And it kind of completely ignored the fact that we actually belong to a species. And you know, how much effect does the wider society have on scientific thought, and how much does scientific thought have an effect on wider society? And have you ever explored that relationship?
Yes, I think I know what you mean, and I'll try and answer it in a couple of different ways. First of all, I think the social milieu that we're in, it always influences science. You can't take science out of your understanding of society and your beliefs and everything like that. And, you know, you've only got to go back to when they were first using a microscope and looking down the microscope at sperm, for example. They thought they could see little people, you know, crouched in there, because that was their belief at the time. And so their belief influenced what they saw, you know, these homunculus, they called them. But coming back to your question about whether the selfish gene is really a political thing, yes and no. When it's become political rather than is political, and Dawkins was the one who wrote the book, The Selfish Gene, but it really came from this book that E.O. Wilson wrote in 1975 called Sociobiology, The New Synthesis. And that in itself was based on this concept of kin selection that a guy called Bill Hamilton had written about in the 60s. And what Wilson did in his book, he wrote this massive book. It's like, if you study behavior, it's almost like a Bible for you. It's phenomenal, his breadth of understanding and everything he pulled together. But the last two chapters he devoted to humans. and said, well, these same principles should theoretically apply to humans. And the idea of being selfish, the idea of being territorial. And this created a stink, you know, a big political stink, because people said, well, that goes against everything that we believe in society is, you know, democracy and looking after our fellows and all that sort of thing. And so I think what happened with sociobiology is because of that fury, it became a political thing. You know, are we selfish? Are we not? But the reality is that Darwin's mechanism for natural selection really revolves around individuals behaving selfishly. It's the key to understanding it. And, you know, so, and there's a notion that animals behave for the good of the species, and that's a complete fallacy. It's what we call the group selection fallacy. And you'll often hear this on TV. They'll say, oh, this so-and-so animal has done something that's going to help the species survive or refrain from this. And you can show very easily by modeling it that that could never be sustainable, would never work in the real world. Yeah.
So
I'm sorry if I've dented
no,
your...
No, not dented. I want to explore that idea, that concept, because I think it's really, really interesting, because I think there's, you know, there's that dynamic about, you know, is individualism or group, you know, which is more important. But it is a dynamic, isn't it? It's not one or the other. It's no answer.
Well,
so there's no one answer, isn't, you know, because we do sacrifice ourselves for our groups, like for kins.
Yeah, for your kin. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but the thing is that when you understand that from the point of view of the individual, like yeah. if you think that, you know, I alarm call or I look after these group of animals because I'm related to them, if you understand that what I'm really doing is looking after myself, because by doing that I pass on my own genes as well, then it still is selfish. And that's the misconception, I think, that animals behave for the good of the group. They very rarely behave for the good of the group. And you know, I know from you know, a sustainability factor, that must be daunting, because you know, but. You know, I mean, it was Garrett Hardin, wasn't it, who came up with the tragedy of the commons, and that, and that even as humans, we probably tend to behave selfishly. Now, I'm not saying that humans are subject entirely just to natural selection, because we clearly have social mores and cultural things that overlay that and affect our behavior. But if you look at understanding behavior from an evolutionary perspective, it very seldom involves any sort of notion of doing something for the good of the group, unless there is some benefit that derives to the animal that's actually performing the behavior.
Do you get adoptions in penguins?
You sort of do, accidentally. They pick up on... they have mechanisms that stop chicks from moving from one nest to the other, but if you move them, and I've done this myself, if you actually move them across the nest, they'll actually if the chicks are young enough, they'll adopt them and look after them. But if they're old enough, they won't, because there's a mechanism that kicks in terms of recognition, and then they'll just look after their own chicks.
So is there ever a conflict between behavior and natural selection, like the behavior? You know, a behavior that's encouraged, I don't know, that comes out that is not good for them?
Well, if you're asking, if you're saying, will animals do things that are not for the good of the species or the group as a whole, but it's encouraged by natural selection for the animals to behave selfishly? Yes, definitely. I mean, there's been examples of animals, overeating the food resources they have, and you know, if you were saying, well, they were doing something for the good of the group, they would refrain from either reproducing or from eating all the food, but they don't, because it's always the individual that's looking for benefit. I don't know if that's quite answered your question, but it's a difficult one.
Yeah, so I suppose for humans, right, we can understand that, for instance, we're eating too much and we're degrading our environment and, you know, we should stop. Okay. So what point then does our chosen behaviors conflict with our our evolution? Have we the idea that some people have that we somehow stopped evolving, that sometimes how we were hunter gatherers, we were all the weak species. I mean, I probably wouldn't have lasted very long because my eyesight's pretty bad, so I would have been culled from the pool, and my younger brother would have done really, really well because he's got good eyesight. So so is there a point at which we've become farmers and we've created this vast society that allows weaker members of our physical specimens to sustain themselves and succeed? Is this somehow affecting our?
You're really getting into an area that guessing in, but I mean, for example, your brother might well have brought you food and kept you alive because you'd probably be a reproductive machine, I imagine, and you produce offspring that would be related to him. So that could work that way. So you wouldn't necessarily be killed out.
You might have been cleverer than him.
Exactly. Yes. You might have. Exactly. If you were really clever, you would have got him to go and get the food.
Cook.
Yeah. But, for example, evolution never stops. Yeah. I mean, we're always subject to it. We're always subject to things. It's just that we can do things, humans can do things that allow them to succeed even in the face of, difficulties. And essentially, if you like, thumb their nose at evolution, but we're still subject to it. I mean, our species as a species won't survive unless we take cognizance of the fact that we are part of nature. We exist only by dint of the fact that we live in an ecosystem which we have to be a functional part of.
So that gets onto the science education bit, because I don't know if you mentioned that you're the Stuart Professor of Science Communication.
Yeah, Sam did. Yeah,
and so.
We would have had an introduction, but no one was here to give it.
And, sorry. So science communication. So we've communicated that we're in, for instance, in big trouble, melting the planet slowly. And, let's read in this article that, the Arctic's melting much more quickly. We know what's happening. So what's the problem? Why aren't we doing something about it? Is there a gap between communicating knowledge and then acting upon that knowledge, and what's happening there?
I think to use that specific example of climate change, I think it's a really complex thing. I think there's definitely a gap between, as you say, knowing about something and acting on it. So I think that's just that void that exists anyway. But even in the terms of the communication, I think there's major difficulties. The majority of people, if you ask them, they don't know much about climate change. They've heard of it. They don't really know the facts behind it, and not enough anyway to really make a balanced judgment. And most people get their knowledge of climate change actually from broadcast television news. I mean, it's so I think it really behoves us as scientists or communicators to give people a better understanding of the science involved, and that's where science communication comes in, because it's not enough just to have thrown some facts and figures at someone. You need to be able to present it in a way that they can understand it and then make viable decisions for themselves.
One of the things I really mean to think about, like at school, my son's at school, and at school there's right and wrong answers all the way through. So it's black and white. This is the right answer, this is the wrong answer, because it's in the book. But as soon as he hits science, you go, well, actually the world's not like that. It's quite grey. Is there a huge problem with our education system, the way it there's right and wrong answers, and there's exams, answers that you have to give in exams, which are, set questions and set answers. Is there some fundamental flaw in the way we're educating our children to understand that, and then, because science is grey, science is always about this constant re-examination and demolishing of our knowledge and recreating new knowledge.
I don't know that there's anything wrong in the education system, because it seems to me that what limited knowledge I have of the education system here at the moment is that they seem to be moving much more into problem solving, and I actually think that it's not a problem with the science that's presented, but it's an understanding that, as you say, science has areas of grayness to it, or if you like, probability. Science is all about probability, and people have difficulty with that, because it's like sort of looking for a weather forecast and it tells you there's a 60% chance it's going to rain. Well, what do? You know, 60%, you know. And that's the trouble with scientists have with communicating things, is they don't like to speak in absolutes. It's a really hard job to get a scientist to actually say, yes, it is increasing in temperature here, and it's due to human-induced changes. You know, like, to get someone to say black and white like that. And I think as communicators of science, we realize that people need things to be less in a probabilistic kind of way and more expressed in ways they can easily digest. And so they don't want the vagueness that often comes from when you get a scientist being interviewed. And I think it's really one of the keys to teaching scientists or people that communicate about science is to get them not to lie, not to be misrepresenting the data, but to at least be more forceful about it and more exact in terms of not exact in terms of being vague, but exact in terms of definite.
In writing, say, children's stories, if you go right down to that level, does it matter if you have to invent bits? Do you have to invent penguins' names? And not to the extent of, you know, Pingu.
Yeah.
Has got a suburban lifestyle living in an igloo. Clearly, is that doing good or bad?
Well, most of it's doing good, I would say, except that living in an igloo is not so good, because that implies they live with Eskimos in the northern hemisphere and penguins live in the southern hemisphere. So that's one of those misconceptions about penguins we're always trying to battle. But I think with children, it doesn't matter what you use as the embellishments, as long as the facts that are being communicated are correct. And I like the idea of dressing them up with names and things like that for children. And one of the worst things that you have to overcome as someone communicating science is the first thing you have to do is engage. And you can't engage children or really anyone unless you make what you're talking about interesting. You know, it's not good enough just to say, I've got all the answers here. I've got all the knowledge. Knowledge by itself is uninteresting, boring, and unless you present it in an interesting way, people are not going to take it in.
Was that an aha moment for you? At some point, did you wash in a sea of numbers and thought, it's more about the story here?
Actually, yes. I did have a moment like that once. I was down on the Antipodes Islands, which are about 700 or 800 kilometres southeast of here, in the middle of nowhere. It's like just about the worst place ever to get to. Like, no one ever goes there. And it was really difficult to get there. 2.5 days on a boat, being sick the whole time. And so we get there and we're studying the behavior of these penguins that live there, erect-crested penguins, the least studied penguins at all. And it was hard work. There were three of us and we're working around the clock and doing 6 hours observations a day. And down there, very seldom do you have a day where it doesn't rain. So you're basically sitting in the rain or the drizzle most of the time, 3 hours at a time, taking observations. Then I'd have 3 hours off and then I'd come back and do another 3 hours of observations. And in that 3 hours downtime, just about everyone went back to the hut and recuperated, had tea, coffee, or whatever else they could find of my alcohol, which I'd taken. I was the only one that took alcohol down there, unfortunately. But anyway, during that 3 hours, I often used to go around and photograph things and film things. And I remember this one moment. I was down in another colony of penguins, and there's a bloody great elephant seal had sort of lumbered its way into the penguin colony and gone to sleep. And I mean, right next to, like literally 5 or 6 centimeters from penguin nests all around it. And it was asleep. And I just knew that this thing was going to have to wake up. And it couldn't reverse. It didn't have a reverse gear. It was going to have to lumber forward through the penguin colony and just create bedlam. So I set up my cameras, and I had a film camera and a still camera, and I just waited for this thing to wake up. And it was something like 2 hours that I just sat there waiting. And then it did wake up. And what was amazing was this 4-kilogram penguin took on this 400-kilogram elephant seal and just started pecking it, and it was just bedlam, and I captured it all on film, and I took some photos, and I got such a buzz out of it. You know, there was so much adrenaline going, and I thought, geez, I've been sitting out there for 3 hours a day, getting bored out of my mind, taking down all this data, but just the simple act of anticipating what was going to happen and photographing in a way that I could then use in an article, which I did, in a popular article, I got such a buzz out of that, and it's such a realization that, this is what I really want to be doing, rather than, it's not that I dislike the science, it was just that the science by itself wasn't enough for me.
And subsequently, you've written several books.
Yes.
You've taught films, you've made your own films.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Children's books and science-y books, as well as the, I don't know how you describe the Darwin one, is it a science book?
It is really. I mean, it's a travelogue come personal memoir come science book. But the main purpose of it really is to communicate science so the reader doesn't even know it's being used to sort of drip feed them science. It's what I call science in a bun.
And you teach that to students?
Mm-hmm, yes.
Most of them doing film?
Probably about half are doing film, and the rest are doing writing, or what we call popularizing science, which might be working on something to do with the internet, websites, podcasts even, and things like museum displays and so forth.
And are they scientists learning to communicate, or are they communicating people learning science?
Good question. They can be both. The majority of our students, probably about 2/3, have a science background. But we're unusual, and most science communication programs throughout the world require their students to have a science degree. We don't, and there's a few places like one in Mexico that don't either. And my argument has always been that what's important is communicating their science, and if you have bright, creative people, that's what matters. And, you know, like, I mean, I quickly reached my sort of intellectual top limit in physics a long time ago, and so that wouldn't stop me from being able to communicate physics or something about physics, because there's actually an advantage in not knowing much about a subject, because in a sense, for you to understand it, you have to really come to grips with it and be able to reduce it down to its most basic parts, and that's a huge advantage in being able to communicate.
Because you have to ask questions that mightn't occur to someone who's an expert in the field, because they just assume you know it.
Absolutely. You put your finger on it right away. That's exactly the thing, that so many times when you get someone who's very familiar with a topic, they just glaze over the really basic stuff because they assume everyone knows that. But, of course, they don't, and most people are too polite to ask.
So what are if you're going to list the top three things that those students learn?
Well, the key thing that we teach is storytelling. And basically that means that if you're going to communicate anything, humans respond well if it's in the form of a story. And the evidence shows that we learn better if something's in the form of the story. So that's what we that's the most fundamental thing we teach is how to present your science in the form of some engaging story. And engagement is another part of it, is that, as I said before, it's not enough just to have the information there. You've somehow got to attract the eyes or the ears and get the people to want to listen or watch or read whatever you're producing. And so it's design is a big part of that. It's what you use to, and this is where the creative element comes in. It's how you package something to make it interesting. And for another thing, let me think. Three things. You want three things. That's very greedy of you.
But, I want three things. I was. You talked about absolutes and the vagueness, and I think there's something in there that I'd like to explore a little bit about the. To what extent we've sort of touched on this, but I want to come back to it. To what extent do they stick to the science? And in terms of creating stories, presumably it's about building up dramatic tension and that sort of stuff. Do you have to have goodies and baddies? Are you trying to avoid goodies and baddies?
You guys, you're very good questioners, because the key to a story is actually having some form of tension there, having something at stake, having some jeopardy. If you don't have jeopardy, where something is at stake, then you don't really have a good story. So that's key. But to sort of go to the first part of your question, how much of the science is in there really depends on your audience. So you've got to know your audience. So if you're, I don't know, presenting something to the Ornithological Society of New Zealand, for example, you might present it very differently to, say, a Plunket group in South Dunedin or something like that. So I hope I haven't slandered Plunket or South Dunedin.
Does that mean, though, that you have to, if you're going for a general audience, is it dumbing it down?
No, it's not dumbing it down. I mean, I think that's the mistake that a lot of people make, is that you don't actually present the information accurately. It just means that you package it in a way that's easily understood. And so the key thing initially is to get rid of all the jargon. It's the worst feature of scientists is that, you know, they spend 7 or 8 years at university learning to be a member of a club. And the membership of the club is the jargon you learn. I mean, the worst people are biochemists. I mean, I've never been to a seminar given by a biochemist where they don't use, you know, acronyms and heaps of jargon. And unless you're part of that club, you can't understand it. And that's no good at all for talking to the members of the public. You need to get rid of that jargon. And so it's not dumbing down. It's just, it's using one word where, you know, five-syllable words have been used.
What's the hardest story to tell?
The hardest story? Yeah.
Someone came to you and said, I want to tell something about this. And you think, I have no idea how to do that. Have you had that experience?
I can't say that I have, although I perhaps should, because now there's going to be a lot of people come to me, I'm sure, with ideas that I will have no idea how to tell. I'm sure there are a lot of difficult subjects to deal with because of their sensitivity. You know, things involving child molestation or things like that. You've got to be so careful with anything that any subject like that that can strike a raw nerve with people, because the idea of most communication is not to piss people off. It's really to engage people. Sometimes you do that deliberately. You can be provocative. But, I mean, I could come up with subjects now, but they probably wouldn't be good to say over the radio. What
if you're trying to – one of the questions that we ask quite a few people, particularly the education-leaning people in the sustainability space, is do you need to front-load the story with – stories of doom?
Actually, no. And I think what happens is the public get really turned off by stories of doom. They want hope. And in fact, it became very fashionable to have conservation documentaries on television, to the point where, you know, people got sick of them because they were always the same story. They always ended with this, you know, doom and gloom and the world is going to hell in a handbasket. And people want empowerment. They want some way of knowing that even if the news is bad, there's something they can do about it. And one of the best examples I've seen of that is the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. And there you're obviously dealing with a terrible subject. And especially for children, it's a really awful thing to have to come to grips with. And yet they don't shy away from it. There's a whole section there where children get taken through and they see the horrors of what went on. But they also get empowerment. At the end of it, they've got an opportunity to write their feelings down, post them on a board, and draw pictures. And so they feel they can do something. And I think that's the key, that if you have bad news, don't just hit people over the head with a hammer. Give them the bad news, but show them the hope, show them the way. Otherwise, I think they get very turned off. It's like those adverts for drinking and driving, you know, or smoking is bad for you. I mean, okay, put a picture of a, you know, gumless person on the cigarette packet. That's not going to turn off the smokers, because they don't even see that picture after a while. It's not there. So it's really, doom by itself is not good. Doom plus empowerment is good.
One of the things that I've been thinking about a lot recently has been, you know, we watch David Attenborough's, you know, he's an amazing communicator, incredible man. But when we're looking at nature in that way, we're looking at it from the outside. And this is amazing nature. And there's very few, seldom human beings in his stories. How do we start to put humanity back into nature, and with the objective of making us understand they're actually part of this world? We're not sitting outside it, looking at it, or using it as a thing to be used. How do you start doing that, or is that something that we should be doing?
Oh, absolutely, and I think people are doing it. It's true that Attenborough makes what we call blue chip natural history documentaries, and they tend not to have people in. And there's the classic sort of situation where you've got lions or whatever in the Serengeti, and if you pull away the camera, you see there's, you know, five or six, maybe more, Land Rovers all there with people with cameras and so forth watching them. It's not this pristine environment that you would get from just looking at what was going on down the camera. And I think of a documentary called Darwin's Nightmare, which really showed what was happening in Africa with regard to the fish there in this particular lake, and it didn't shy away from saying, this is the environment, this is what we're doing to it, and these are the effects on the people. And I think there are people that are making those sorts of documentaries. I mean, it won a lot of awards on the film festival circuit. Of course, the thing is that, and this is the thing, that television broadcasters, they don't care about the environment. They don't care about anything like that. What they care about is advertising. They want to make money. And so what they put on television is not determined by any social conscience or anything. It is entirely determined by what people will watch. And if people are more likely to watch, reality programs or funny programs about animals, you know, that don't have a serious message to them, it's very hard to compete in that space. I mean, and that's one of the difficulties that especially things like conservation films now really have, is that unless you're Attenborough, it's very hard to get the broadcasters to take a conservation film on.
Has anybody successfully made a reality elimination race type nature documentary? Would the two play nicely?
Oh, yeah, I think there are examples of that kind of thing, like where I'm thinking of an Australian series where they gave cameras to a group of people randomly chosen. Well, I don't know how randomly chosen they were, and then they went out and filmed various things around the world. There's ways of doing that reality thing and applying it to something like conservation. But I remember we put on a festival in Wanaka a few years ago called Wild South, the International Film Festival, and we had a guy over from Animal Planet. He was very big in Animal Planet, and he started telling us about the programs that they were just approving, one of which was called Doga, or Dogs Doing Yoga. And you start to realize, just at a fundamental base level, just what you're up against, because then that all they're after is content that that titillates rather than, as I said, any sort of social content.
So how can serious message compete with that?
I think it's very difficult, and that's where I come back to the idea that it's not enough to simply have the message, not enough to have the data and the knowledge. You have to package it. You have to make it exciting. And so that might mean that even though you're a scientist, you're going to package the story you're telling with rock music or cartoons or whatever. You know, you might get a top model to present it. You know, anything at all that will engage the public.
Do you think it's okay using any of those sorts of devices, you know, getting the Top Gear people to present it, whatever it takes?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because I think you're not selling out, you're not changing the message, but what you're doing is you pulling in the eyes and the ears. And unless you do that, you might as well be standing outside shouting into the wind. People are not going to hear you.
One of the big things that I've been looking for is ways of communicating systems thinking. What people tend to do is reduce things down to the smallest possible thing and then just tell that little bit of the story. But that notion of the complexity and the linking, is that something that people are working on?
I'm not quite sure I understand the question exactly, but I think it's a very difficult thing to do because the easiest thing when you're telling a story or conveying anything is to focus down. And in fact, if you don't focus, you can often confuse. So it's kind of like you're sort of competing against yourself in a sense that if you want to tell the big picture and as you say, the systems approach. So I think it takes a special kind of communicator to be able to do that.
A special kind of communicator that can string things together or somehow zoom out?
Yes, exactly that. And there are various enhancements you can use, like CGI and things like that, to make your points understandable, use of metaphor and things like that. So someone like Carl Sagan was a good communicator in that kind of systems kind of field.
What are you working on now? You're on study leave at the moment, I hear.
Yes, I am. Much as I didn't want to ever write another penguin book, I'm writing another book on penguins. And this one is part memoir, part a description of what we've understood about penguins in the last sort of 35 years. But in the course of doing that, I've come across a really cool story, and it's about one of the very early penguin biologists who was down with Scott. And so I'm pursuing that madly as well. And I plan probably at the end of it to have two books rather than one.
And it's a story of that person's exploration?
Well, it's his revelations about penguins and how they relate to mine. So it's sort of the two of us, really, the two penguin men.
How far has it gone in 100 years?
Ah, well, that's really what it's about. And in some ways, we've come a long way. We understand much more about penguins than we ever did. And if you read all the early stuff, they treated them very much like they were little people, which is, I think, how people often look at them, because they're upright and they seem like they walk along in little tuxedos. And so we know a lot, and especially through technology, because penguins are at sea 80% of their time. So we've been able to use little devices we can put on penguins and monitor their behavior at sea and things like that. But some of the basic things about penguins, they're still pretty much as they were then, and that's part of what the book's about.
Do we know much about them at sea?
Oh, yes, we know heaps. We know where they go. We know how far they, you know, how many times they dive, how deep they dive, what food they eat. We know quite a lot. And it's all because of things like GPS, satellite tracking, little miniaturization of little computers that we can put on penguins that monitor everything, you know, the temperature of the water they're in, the salinity of the water and so forth.
And are they the canary in the coal mine?
Absolutely. And that is principally what penguin biologists have been saying for a long time, that you have an animal which breeds on the land but which goes out to forage often at great distances from the colony. And how well they're doing is determined by how well they can get the food that they need, and that in itself is influenced by things like fishing, pollution, sea surface temperatures as a result of climate change and so forth. So you really can use penguins to monitor the health of the oceans.
And what challenges do you have for the next couple of years? Finishing this book? Finishing two books, perhaps?
Finishing the two books, hopefully looking at a documentary coming out of that, and moving into the next phase with the Centre for Science Communication, because we're just undergoing a major change there with new staffing and expansion. And we started that in 2008, and in the course of the 5 years that we've been running, we're the largest in the world now in terms of postgraduate study of science communication. But just being large by itself is not enough in terms of student numbers and that. What we really need to be is a place that's really recognized as a leader in the field for the influence that we have on the field. And I think we can only get that if we combine our research to support what we do in terms of having really good student outcomes, which is what we do already.
How will you know when you've gotten there?
I hope there's a big sign that says you've arrived. But no, I don't think you ever know. I think it's a place that you aim for. I think we'll know when we're getting, and we're starting to get this now, you know, that people are writing reviews about science communication. They're now referring to us and pointing to us and things like that. So where it's accepted that we are one of the, you know, if not the leading place in the world for science communication, then I think we'll have some idea. But at the moment, we're still the new kids on the block, and we need to prove ourselves, I guess.
What drives you in doing this stuff?
I've always, since I was about 13, wanted to emulate what Attenborough and people like Gerald Darrell did. And it's, for me, it's about understanding my own place in the world. It's, you know, what's it all about, Alfie? And in doing that, I guess, try to communicate to people about that, or ways of enhancing that, our understanding of that, because fundamentally that seems to me the most important thing. It's no good doing science for science's sake. I know that can satisfy some people, but for me it's really, having got that, it's painting the big picture. And I always remember, in fact, when I was in the Antarctic, I used to have, the first time I went down to the Antarctic, I took down some Thoreau with me, and I wrote out a quotation from Thoreau and put it on the wall as a reminder to me, because it really encapsulated everything I believed at the time. And he said, "Color, which is the poet's wealth, is so expensive that most take to mere outline sketch and become men of science." And that really summed it up, that by being a scientist, you're just looking at a part of the world. You're just, you know, I didn't want to be a man of science. I wanted to be a poet. And so that's really it, that it's that part of me that wants to combine the colour of the world with the black and white sketch that we do as scientists.
But are you an activist, artist, or poet?
People would probably say I was neither.
You're an activist, I'm not scientist then.
I don't know whether I'd call myself an activist. I'm a promoter more than anything. And I'd like to think that there was a part of me that had poetic leanings, not in the sense of being able to write poetry, but at least colouring the things I write about and the things I produce.
That's fantastic. Thank you.
Okay, you've been listening to Sustainable Lens on Otago Access Radio on 105.4 FM. This has been the show for the 15th August 2013. Our guest tonight was Professor Lloyd Davis, and our panelist is Professor Samuel Mann, and your host is me, Shane Gallagher. Our music is sourced in the Free Music Archive. You can get all podcasts of previous shows on sustainablelens.org, where you can subscribe in iTunes or on oir.org.nz. We hope you enjoyed the show.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.